Welcome to the Engineering Influence Podcast, presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies and sponsored by the ACEC Life Health Trust. Today, we're talking about standard of care. This can be a huge contractual issue for engineering firms because failing to deal with it properly can open up a firm to substantial liability. So what is standard of care? Here's the wording that today's guest recommends for defining standard of care in a contract. Quote, in providing services under this agreement, the consultant will endeavor to perform in a manner consistent with the degree of care and skill ordinarily exercised by members of the same profession currently practicing under similar circumstances, close quote. So to talk with us about standard of care today is Daniel Bulow, who is Managing Director of Willis A&E's Architects and Engineers Division. So let's start off with, what liability does a firm incur from having an elevated standard of care in its contract?
Well, thanks, Jerry, and thanks for having me. First of all, I'd like to lead by telling everybody here, I'm not an attorney. And as a broker, I'm an insurance broker that's been specializing in architects and engineers for 20 plus years. I cannot practice law. But so the perspective that I look at this from is in advising our clients, our architects and engineers clients with Willis, is what's insurable or not. And so that's the real issue as far as we're concerned when it comes to the standard of care, because the design firm's professional liability insurance, which is by far their greatest exposure and the most important coverage on the property casualty side, is closely aligned to that of the standard of care. So if you find yourself going over and above the standard of care, you may very well find yourself in a potentially uninsurable position.
And so that's essentially, if you go over standard of care, your liability insurance carrier is not going to be, it's not going to be coming to the rescue at that point.
It very well, and we'll have some examples here, but it certainly can be problematic. I mean, we'll do everything we can to fight for that coverage. But when we're looking at contracts and these indemnity agreements and such, these design firms are really looking at, you know, what is insurable and what's not insurable. And it's often aligned really with the standard of care. Because a good design professional's professional liability policy should essentially cover anything and everything that that design professional does for their errors and omissions as a practice.
So why isn't there just a standard of care clause that's in every engineering contract, and it's not amended, it's just there?
Well, there essentially is, as you've just, you know, described there, but it's applied on a case-by-case basis, because if you think of it, every design is a prototype, you know, at the end of the day. And so as you define standard care is you know, defined that it's typically or ordinarily exercises in the performance of professional services for a comparable project in the same general geographic area with access to the same resources and so on. The problem is when an owner drafted contract includes such words as highest and or to the owner's satisfaction, which can be arbitrary or very difficult to meet and overly broad. The other problem is that while they may have a reasonably fair standard of care provision in an owner drafted agreement, they will often include additional provisions in that same agreement that are not fair and that are in fact over and above the standard of care. For example, they may include that definition that you outlined there, but they may include a defend obligation within the indemnity, or they may include stop work authority within the scope of services, or requiring that the design professional is responsible for job site safety or construction means or methods. So regardless that that's in there, we have to really read on the rest of that agreement to make sure that there's nothing else in there that's going to take us over and above the standard of care.
So it to my mind, it feels sort of like an unfair battle if you've got the owner's attorney writing contracts that the engineer needs to decipher. I mean, is it enough for an engineering firm to rely on their own ability to figure out whether a contract is going to push them over the standard of care or those other issues, the duty to defend and such? Or really, does a firm need to have a lawyer look at every single contract?
Well, again, you know, when it comes to these policies, these insurance policies and these contracts, of course, are legal documents. And so if a design professional is faced with any unfamiliar language, you know, it would always be our advice to certainly, you know, seek legal counsel for anything that's questionable. So you get into some of these contracts these days, unfortunately, they are very complex with multiple indemnities embedded in these agreements and issues around the statute of limitations and so forth, that you really, it would be our advice to seek legal counsel. And so our advice is that design firms need to be, you know, aware of these issues. They know, need to know, as we'll describe, as our deal makers, deal breakers, but they also need to know when to go to their broker to ensure that they're meeting their insurability issues and there's nothing in there that could create an insurability issue, but also when in doubt, certainly seek legal advice. I would add to that, you know, there's definitely a lot of over-lawyering going on, right? And to your point here is like, you know, do we really have to let these two attorneys hash it out? When ultimately the best case scenario, in my view, is that you're also going to have the project team members and certainly leaders of these organizations also at the table, ideally. And I know in public agreements, unfortunately, that can be very difficult, if not possible sometimes. But the point is that what you're trying to do is you're trying to establish and manage expectations using that contract as a vehicle. And so I don't care how good your contract is, if you didn't have an opportunity to talk about, you know, expectations and take the responsibility as a design firm to educate your client as to the standard of care, your scope of services and so forth, I don't care how good your contract is, you missed a really important opportunity to establish and manage those expectations, because that's where most of these claims are coming from against design professionals. They're not actually rooted in errors and omissions. We certainly are seeing claims where there's actual errors and omissions, and with the staffing issues, we see a rise in that. But historically, most of these claims are rooted in expectations not being established between the parties and not being actively managed by the design professional.
On the idea of expectations, I mean, I could see how to an uneducated owner or an inexperienced owner might be a better way of putting it, saying you're only going to meet what an average engineer in your marketplace working with the same materials and resources would meet, they might say, well, you're just promising me to do average work. I thought you were a great engineering firm. What's going on here?
Well, it's important to recognize that the design professional is already held to a very high standard of care just by being a design professional, licensed professional in a firm that practices architects and engineers. And so the problem, I think, is what you're alluding to there is that, you know, as a client, I think it's reasonable, like, hey, I hired you. I want the best. So why won't you accept this language in the contract that calls you as such? You know, and the problem is that language that they'll often insert in their highest, for example, you'll perform to the highest standard of care or the best. The problem is that at the end of the day, that language is arbitrary and often difficult to meet. And when it comes down to actual litigation, arbitration as such, you're going to end up with a battle of experts. And there's always an attorney that's going to pay for some expert that's going to say, hey, you know, this firm did an okay job, but they weren't the best. They weren't the highest. And in fact, there's bad legal precedent against a design professional with that type of language in there. And so that's also a great opportunity to talk to the client as far as, well, this is the standard of care, and we just want to be careful with the language and use something that is fair and reasonable and not arbitrary.
Can you have a standard of care in the contract but make verbal promises that don't have any legal impact?
You know, a verbal agreement is worth the paper it's written on. You know,
okay.
At the end of the day, this is something you really want to have in writing. It's very important that you do that. And so, and one of the things that we always recommend with our clients too, is that every firm should have their own standard terms and conditions and use that essentially as a list of your greatest hits, right? And it can be a one-page form that you can use, and you would use that as part of a letter agreement and certainly you would use that instead of ever going on a project on a verbal basis, because in there it's going to include not only the standard care, but you know the fact it's the contractor's sole responsibility for job site safety and such. And then I would have that in place and have it in written that we will go forward with this in place until we have agreed upon contract.
When is an ideal time to bring up standard of care in the sales process? Do you want to bring it up early, or do you want to wait until you've got the contract in front of you and just sort of point it out?
Well, I think that first and foremost, your contract is by far the most important vehicle, I believe, to use to really have this discussion, to establish expectations and have some real good dialogue. But I would encourage design firms to be educating their staff and anybody about the basics around contracts. So those folks that are not even maybe responsible for negotiating a contract are aware of the words, if you will, and the things that you're going to want ultimately in a contract. So they are going to be part of that process and have that culture of being able to educate their clients throughout the process. And so I think it's an ongoing process. It certainly leads up to the contract, very important during that contract that you have an important conversation around, again, the standard of care, scope of services and so forth. And then ongoing, you know, you're going to, as I always say, I think it's important to have a dramatic reading with the project team of every contract. You know, what happens often is that you will see design firms, they will have an individual or even a risk management group and attorneys, in-house counsel, that are very good with contracts. And they know a lot about agreements, and they'll negotiate these agreements and then they'll stick it in a drawer. And then they'll send the project team out on the site. And I think they're missing a very important opportunity to get everybody together and have, as I describe, a dramatic reading, go ahead, dress up, whatever you need to do to get the point across here that we have a unique contract. This contract is not perfect. We are ultimately left as a business to assume and control risk. And we're gonna use this as an opportunity to talk with our staff that's gonna be out on the job site. Because how else, for example, would you be able to effectively manage scope creep if you had a bunch of individuals out there that were not privy to that area, the provisions of the agreement?
You and another member of your firm did a program for us a few weeks ago on standard of care. And you talked about contingency funds as being a good point of entry into the standard of care conversation. Could you sort of go into that again?
Sure. I don't think you can have a conversation about a contingency fund without having a conversation about the standard of care. You know, and at the end of the day, the reason is that you're not perfect. There's no such thing as a perfect set of drawings, and this is part of this conversation where you're going to have with your client. You know, the average errors and omissions on new design bid build is 3-6% of construction value, meaning there are no guarantees because the drawings are not perfect, and especially on design build projects where the drawings are incomplete, it could be even greater than that. And if we don't have that if we don't have an understanding that something can and will invariably go wrong and there's no such thing as a perfect set of drawings, you know, then you must ask and have that conversation of who's going to cover, where's that 3-6% going to come from in the event that we do have these errors and omissions, which is within the norm. I always like when you're talking about the standard care and throughout contingencies, there was a legal finding in this great state of Minnesota, where I hail from, where the judge came out in the finding and said something along the lines of in the finding that in favor of the design professional in this case, that the standard of care of a design professional is closer aligned to a lawyer and a doctor than it is a contractor. And just as a lawyer is never going to guarantee they're going to win every case, and a doctor is never going to guarantee they're going to cure every ill, a design professional is not really in a position to guarantee much of anything. You know, essentially is what, it's not verbatim, but that's the sense of it. And the point is that a lot of different clients that you work with don't understand that. They don't get it. And so I think that's another thing I like to stress with our clients is that don't take for granted what your prospective client knows. And again, back to the earlier point about using that contract as a vehicle to establish expectations, you have to ask yourself, if you're working with somebody that's a prospective client at that juncture of your relationship, and they are an unreasonable or unpleasant human being to deal with, how reasonable or pleasant do you think they're going to be down the road when things aren't going perfect?
Well, that's an excellent point. Yeah, that would seem to me to be a red flag if they're willing to push you into an uninsurable risk just to get the contract that they wanted.
You know, and I would just add to that, Jerry, is that it might be another question you have here, but, you know, I think when design professionals really do a great effort, make most of them, you know, I always hate hearing about, well, if you don't sign it, some other guy will sign it or other gal will sign this agreement. Well, you know, I would like to ask, well, what else are they doing where they're not practicing good business, right? Because at the end of the day, the design professional is doing the client a favor to review and look at these agreements. And because a lot of these owner drafted agreements are chock full of provisions that are uninsurable, and that is in nobody's best interest, including the owner. And just because they paid some attorney a lot of money to draft up an agreement, frankly, doesn't mean that attorney knows anything about what they're doing when it comes to professional liability or certainly the standard of care of a design professional. But more importantly, as far as their client's concerned, the owner, they have to recognize that the professional liability insurance is arguably the only asset that they can look to in the event there's an error or omission. The average design firm, there's no bonds in place for this, or there's no assets to look to. So why would you want a contract in place where in one clause you're asking for $2, $3, $5+ million of professional liability insurance coverage, and the next clause you have an uninsurable indemnity? And unfortunately, you know, that's, you know, a lot of folks recognize that are on the design professional side, but it's lost on these clients or the owners, and it's lost on these the attorneys that work for them. But it is important that, and a lot of our clients do an excellent job in learning how to negotiate and learning how to get that point across.
And that does seem to me like the key point, because as you say, it doesn't do the owner any good if there's no way to collect on some uninsurable provision that they pushed into the contract.
Absolutely.
Talking about red flags, what in your experience, what are some red flags that firms just, if they see it in the contract and the owner's not willing to come off of it, they just need to walk?
Well, I always think of business, every firm, and this is something we also, you know, really try to, you know, put out there, is that, you know, it's not our job as a broker to, you know, scare people away from risk or, you know, out of the business even. You know, it's contrary to that. You need to take risk on in order to be rewarded. But you certainly, if anybody's been through a claim, they know that it can be a very costly and an unpleasant expense and event that can really be costly and certainly negate any profit on that particular project. And so there's a lot of things to consider in that question as far as, you know, what to consider. But as far as what I think is important is that every firm needs to have their go, no-go processes in place and look at every project on its own merits. For example, you may have a contract with the city of Chicago that is so bad, that is the basis of our Willis A&E contract from hell seminar, because it's that bad. But you may ultimately be able to, and reasonably so as a firm, decide the project is a go. Even though this contract is a no-go, we know you're never going to get to be an act of Congress to change this thing. And unfortunately, with a lot of public agreements, but you're comfortable as a firm to be able to assume and control that risk because you're looking at your project team capabilities, your experience with that same client, and so on, right? And so ultimately you may decide this is a go, even though the contract is a no-go. But I would take that a step further. I could also see why a firm may say, you know, I'm sorry, we're not going to accept this risk. This is uninsurable and I'm not going to have this hanging over us. But if you do go forward on that, that's why it's so important that everybody in the project team understands what's unique about that contract, because ultimately you're left as a business to assume and control that risk. that you don't have insurance for. So you've made a business decision. How can you mitigate, assume, and control and manage that risk? And that's through effective documentation, communication, and management of that project very actively throughout the course of the project.
So basically, if you have a competent team, an experienced team, you can work your way around some of these uninsurable risks if you have the processes and people in place.
Yes and no. I think you got to look at every project and every owner. So for example, I know folks that have worked with the city of Chicago for 20 plus years and have never had a problem because they just have the experience of doing that. I know folks that have gone into these without that experience and have gotten burned. I could see why one client would say, I'm going to sign that agreement because I've got that experience with that client and my experience with the project team. But I would never suggest you're going to sign that same agreement with some developer you've never worked with for on a private development of a condo project or something like that. So you really got to look at, you know, your ability to assume and control that risk. And so, you know, you look at some of these clauses and you're going to ask them, well, why do you want to defend obligation into this agreement? You know, why is that reasonable or not? And it's uninsurable. Why would you want to take that on and potentially pay the defense costs of the client to essentially sue you? Because that would be a liability assumed under contract that in the absence of that contract would not be insurable. So it's essentially over and above the standard care and therefore uninsurable. Do you want to take that risk on? And that's a business decision folks have to, and anybody that looks at agreements, they know, well, we got to strike that defend obligation. Can we bifurcate that defend? Because we know that under the GL, we can arguably get a defend obligation agreeable to that, but we're going to bifurcate and not agree to it under the professional. I'm coming back to the importance of design professionals to understand the nuances of this these contracts, but also to learn how to negotiate, know your deal makers, deal breakers, and then also bring in your partners, your broker partners, and your attorney legal consultants to help you throughout this process.
So as a broker, what are your top recommendations for not elevating a standard of care in a contract negotiation?
I would lay out these following points. I would say that you want to understand that your professional liability coverage, which is your greatest exposure and your greatest coverage, covering you for your firm for everything from, you know, delay damages, consequential damages, vicarious liability, and so on, and bodily injury and property damage, is all going to come down to your professional liability policy, and that coverage is closely aligned to your standard of care. Okay. And so that you can take yourself over and above that standard of care by your contract or by the actions of your staff on the site. So you need to educate your staff on contracts, what not to put in emails, their field notes, and so forth, because that can also come back to bite you in the event that OSHA comes in as interviewing folks and looking at your documents and so on a particular claim. But they also must understand, you know, construction administration and documentation. And so I think that's very important that you understand that you can take yourself over and above this coverage. And to know your deal breakers and deal makers. And what that is, it's an old DPIC term, and that's where I hail from back before I came and become a broker, is with DPIC companies back in the good old days. And the deal breakers are those things that you really can't have in your agreement as a deal breaker for you. And those are things that, again, everybody's going to have their own appetite for risk and what they may or may not accept. But I don't want to accept job site safety or construction means or methods. I don't want to take on a defend obligation and so on. And then there are those deal makers. You know, I really would like mediation versus arbitration, and how do I negotiate that and so on. So knowing how to negotiate is very important. Negotiating a limitation of liability or a waiver of consequential damages, or getting named on the contractor's GL policy on a primary and non-contributory basis. These are all things that are so important and can only be done by somebody that really understands that. But then also, as I mentioned, is getting the rest of the staff really at least conversant around this and to understand, certainly by having that dramatic reading of a particular contract for a particular project that they're gonna work on, so that they can help and manage that. And so I think that's all important as well. And as a sub-consultant, you know, if you're on that side where you're a sub to a prime, make sure you review and you understand all those agreements that you're going to be bound to. You know, there's often, unfortunately, this flow down, these flow down provisions that can be unfair, and you really have to watch out for. And lastly, I would say, you know, take responsibility of educating your clients. Don't take for granted that they know what they're doing. It really is, I can't overemphasize that. And because at the end of the day, you got to recognize that design professionals, you know, we handle 500 plus design firms around the country, and each one of them are different. And between all of them, they literally are working with every type of human being out there. And if you look at it, for example, on one end of the spectrum, they could be working with a homeowner. And they, here you are trying to interpret some homeowner's dreams as a design professional. And that's an emotionally charged, unsophisticated consumer, right? Or client in this case. So you need to really understand that and manage those expectations. On the other end of the spectrum, you might have a condo developer that knows exactly what they're doing because they got an owner's rep slash attorney and a 3-page indemnity agreement. So how do you manage that? And then in the middle there, you might have a school board, and every time these folks show up, you know, you got a, you know, a whole group of people there at your meetings that seems to be, you know, a whole new group of people that with a tight referendum that all know more than you do, you know. So if you think about it, that's a real challenge that I think design firms have when it comes to this, but it's so important. And communication is so important in any business, but I think for design professionals that work with such a variety of people, folks, some with different standard of cares and so forth, and different delivery methods and different mediums through communication, even BIM and so on, you know, it's a real challenge.
Yeah, the message I get from that is get some help, whether from your broker or from your lawyer or somebody. But that sounds like a lot of potential problems there if you don't know what you're doing.
Well, I'll say that, you know, I always say that, you know, design professionals really do. I mean, we put on these education programs as you do, and I've always been impressed that there really is a lot of interest. And I think that that's important. I think design professionals really do, you know, at the end of the day, they take a lot of pride in what they do, and they really are concerned in working closely with their clients and take pride in that relationship. And sometimes, you know, it's hard for them to separate that and really look at it as from a business standpoint, but they really need to when it comes to contracts and managing expectations and the standard of care.
Well, great. I think that's probably a good place to close. I really appreciate you coming on the program.
I thank you very much, Jerry. You have a great day. Appreciate it.
We've been talking with Daniel Bula, who is Managing Director of Willis A&E's Architects and Engineers Division. And you've been listening to the Engineering Influence podcast presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies and sponsored by the ACC Life Health Trust. Thanks for listening.